This is Gary Shavey with Dr. Jones at Westminster Seminary down in Escondido, California. So Westminster West, right?
Correct.
Well, why don't you first begin to just give us a little bit of background of who is Dr. Jones, where he's born, where he's been, and how he got to Southern California.
All right. I'm actually from Liverpool, England, the cultural capital of the world. The Beatles made that the case. And I was actually a high school friend of John Lennon for many years and played music with him and actually taught him everything he knew. I was not a serious student. I messed around with John Lennon for hours, not taking school or any kind of intellectual endeavor seriously at all. I probably started seriously thinking maybe at the age of 17 or so. I sort of became more committed to studies. And in England, I was the first person in my family that went to university. In fact, I'm wearing my university tie, which only you can see, Gary. And I don't know why I put it on today, but...
It matched.
But, you know, it was something of an achievement to, in those days, to get to university. And I took my studies seriously once I got there. I was raised in a sort of a Pentecostalizing, Baptistic, independent little group that didn't do any theological thinking at all. And so everything was based on experience. And when I got to university, I was faced with this intellectual onslaught. And nobody wanted to know about my experience of anything. And of course, my experience was so weird in a certain sense. You can have all kinds of experiences, and they're difficult to use on their own, you know, as an affirmation of a whole worldview that you have. You can use experience. It's a wonderful thing. I believe the Bible wants us to have serious spiritual experiences, but within the context of the way God describes the world. And the Bible actually is a description of the world. It's a cosmology, a word about the cosmos. Of course, I didn't get that growing up. Maybe some of the guys listening to this do get that, and that's great. But I must say, I didn't get it. At university, I began to read some serious theology, especially biographies of the Puritans, oddly enough. And I was introduced to some good theology through the InterVarsity group at that time. And speakers who came, I was in Wales actually, the University of Wales, and these fine preachers would come and speak. And I got a sense there that there was more to the Christian faith than liver quivers of experience. But the guy who really turned me on was Francis Schaeffer. I began to read Francis Schaeffer, and I got an indication that the Christian faith was not just about, you know, how you experience things, but that it engaged the mind and engaged the world via the mind. And that frankly saved my Christian confession. I was about to give it up. As an intellectual that I'd become, what I was given as a child was not sufficient. So I was very much turned on by Francis Schaeffer, and I did various degrees in liberal schools, and had it not been for Schaeffer, I would have been eaten alive by those liberal schools, because I was still pretty naive about the nature of the world about the nature of academics and liberalism. You know, and I was ready to swallow down all kinds of stuff that my Harvard professors would tell me, that sounds pretty good, you know. And so I was building a smorgasbord of evangelical notions and then liberal ideas, and but without any real understanding of a coherence of a worldview. And I must say, as I said, Francis Schaeffer was a great help. I must say, I was greatly helped by my future wife. While I was studying in Boston, I met this really beautiful woman who was going to Wellesley College. Why she got interested in me, I'll never know, but...
Maybe that's for another time.
Yeah, that's another time. But her father actually was Edmund Clowney, who was president of Westminster in Philadelphia. And, you know, I began to understand that kind of a theological approach to life, and that got me seriously thinking about the construction of a worldview of theological thinking. Well, then, when I'd finished my PhD, my wife, with her great biblical wisdom, said, you know, you want to go to some school in the States and make a name for yourself. But she said, I think you should go where you are the most needed. Not where you want to go, but where you are the most needed. I mean, this was an incredible notion to me. Don't you build your career by, you know, going to the best accredited, the most well-known place? Of course, you're serving the Lord, you know.
Of course.
But you're also serving your career. So she sits me down, and we go through a process of writing down on one list what my gifts are, and on the other list, the needs that my gifts could help fulfill or answer. Well, she won, because when you put all that down, the call to go and teach in France that nobody had ever heard of was overwhelming in terms of its needs, rather than filling a chair here in the United States. So we bundled ourselves up and went to France, to a place that hadn't even been started, to a theological school that some French pastors were planning to get going again. It had been closed down due precisely to liberalism in the Reformed Church of France. And they were looking for a little bit of help. So I get to France and realize that I will be the only Reformed New Testament scholar in the entire French-speaking world. I didn't realize that till I got there. And whoa. So anyway, but it was a genuinely French institution, so I worked for the French and learned the language. My first classes, I was teaching Greek to French students 5 months after I got there, having started learning French when I got there. So I was dealing with three different syntactical systems in public, in front of these very suspicious-looking characters that are French students. So that was a baptism by fire. But, you know, the Lord was gracious to us, and I did learn the language well and develop my thinking theologically during that period. Yeah, after 17 years there, I felt the Lord deep inside was giving me a kick in the butt, asking me to move on, which I didn't want to do because we just built a home where we thought we were going to live for the rest of our lives in southern France. Who wouldn't want to do that? But I had an invitation to come back to the States and teach, and I didn't want to do it. My children didn't want to come. I have 7 children. They all were complaining, we don't want to go to the States. My wife cried for a year and a half, and she's American. She didn't want to leave France. The moderator of the French Reformed denomination shook his finger at me and said, "You're making the wrong decision." I had delegations of students show up at my house at 6 o'clock in the morning, wake me up, get me out of bed, and tell me I was making the wrong decision. But in all of that, I somehow felt that it was God's time for me to move from that situation over here, but I couldn't tell you why. That was really weird. I just sensed that it was. I got back here. After 6 months, I published my first book in English. It was called The Gnostic Empire Strikes Back. And really what I'm actually describing is culture shock. The Lord knew why He was moving me from a situation of classic European secular humanism, where, you know, the debate is a rationalistic debate about the possibility of the supernatural or the mere natural, to a world that I didn't recognize, namely America, where I saw the growth of this spiritual option at the very heart of the Christian faith in the modern world, namely, quote, Christian, unquote, America. A sort of an incubator, oddly enough, of faith, but of a faith that is the very antithesis of biblical faith. Not an atheism or a materialism, which is opposed to the Christian faith now, but a serious spirituality, even more, in a certain sense, opposed to the Christian faith. Because ultimately, I came to realize that the real struggle for truth is not between materialism and spiritualism. It's between two kinds of spirituality. And the reason is, of course, we are spiritual beings. God has made us spiritual beings. So don't be surprised. You know, this throwaway line, people of faith, you know. It's the whole justification of the interfaith movement. We people of faith need to hang together. It is indeed a line to be thrown away. The reason being that it is precisely spiritual people who are in conflict over the true nature of the world. And I think people are still being fooled by that notion that if you're spiritual, then you must be the same, essentially. You know. To me, it was an incredible challenge. First of all, to say to myself, where on earth did this come from? At that time, it was, well, when I came back, it was 91, just to situate myself in time and space. It was 91, and Shirley MacLaine's book had come out in 89, which I managed to read, and I really could not understand where this stuff, which planet it had come from. I had come to the States at 64 to study, and I was so amazed by how Christian everything was in the States. And I come back in 91, having had that time in secular France. America is still spiritual, but there's this strange spirituality growing up in the very core of the nation, in many places of influence that, as I say, we used to call New Age, but we don't use that term anymore. There are new terms now. Often you find the term the new spirituality, or you find a term like progressive spirituality. I think the best one is integrative spirituality.
That's Wilbur?
Wilbur. Ken Wilbur, who is one of the great gurus of Brian McLaren. One of the most profoundly, I'm not talking about McLaren, I'm talking about Wilbur. One of the most gifted pagan thinkers I've ever read. He is amazing. He has a list of 9 levels of transformation. And of course the world is evolving, you know, to more and more levels of unity, spiritual unity. On this level of 9 sort of chronologically logical developments of human consciousness, number 4 is biblical theism. Number 5 is secular humanism. So when Brian McLaren tells us that, you know, this kind of thinking is what is determining what he thinks, you know where biblical theism is on that scale of transformation. Well, I discovered people like Wilbur. I mean, I started off with Shirley MacLaine as a bit of a lightweight, but she's quite intelligent. But I began to discover more and more that this was a movement that was much more powerful than what we just dismissed as New Age chakras, crystals, and expensive weekends to get in touch with your higher self. And I'm now quite convinced that this movement is the option being proposed to reconstruct the community of the planet in the years to come. That planetary community will be built upon a fundamental understanding of the world from a religiously pagan worldview. What do I mean by pagan? The worship, as Paul says, of creation rather than the creator. It is the idea that the world itself is divine, and thus we are divine, and we co-create with all of the world to make, and we fit, of course, we fit evolution into this, which is very helpful, because if all is one, and one is all, then the way things are is the way they should be, but nobody can accept that. So you throw in this final hangover from secular humanism, which is evolution, and you get this almost pagan eschatology, you know, where, oh, but we do have to develop a little more into this unified planetary world, and then we will solve all our problems, you see, when everything is the same, all distinctions are erased, then we will know this great moment of spiritual unity with everything. That's basically the vision that is driving so many elements in our modern world today, from the United Nations to, you know, sort of a global view of commerce. I'm not saying everybody thinks that way, but I know that there are many people within those things.
Yeah, even just the whole push for the green,
that's
green
right.
planet.
Ecology is just shot through with these people.
Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie buying an island in Dubai just to be eco-friendly.
That's right, yeah. How many of us can afford to do
yeah,
that?
Yeah, exactly.
Apparently these islands go for $35 million. A few more collections at Mars Hill and maybe we could buy
them.
But see, I do feel from the ruins of secular humanism that the world needs to be reconstructed. And some people are saying we'll only be able to reconstruct it with a new myth. A myth, not reason. Well, you've got two possibilities. You've got Christianity and you've got paganism. And I think that's the great face-off, even though Wilbur tries to sort of push Christianity down to this fourth level of the 9 steps of transformation, it really is not a clear understanding of the way Christianity calls into question his whole system of thinking. In other words, it is a conflict between theism and what I've been calling monism, the theory of oneness, and it's all through that stuff. Theism is the distinction between the creator and the creature. I call that twoism. The world is
catchy.
But
it's catchy.
It's catchy. I had to make that up in French a couple of weeks ago, because dualisme doesn't work, because that has all kinds of baggage to it. The word in French for two is de. So I came up with this barbarism, deisme. And the French students...
Because you don't want dualism necessarily.
No, no,
you want two, though.
No, but you want to affirm that in existence there are two kinds.
Yeah.
There's the existence of God, who is totally different than we are.
Well, if you label it in French anyway, it sounds cool.
It does.
Anyway, so...
All right, well, let's call it deisme. And no one will know what I'm talking about.
Just a definition.
and then the other, of course, is there is no God outside, so that everything is one. Everything shares the same essence, and that's monism, this unity of all things. I have all kinds of terms for describing this stuff.
And this is what we want to get at. When you come up January 8th, is the free event at night is the walking in the land of blur, because it's this
right.
Oneism.
That's right.
This blur all the lines.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I call that synthesis. That is, I like to talk about antithesis, that there is a distinction between God and the world, and there are distinctions between truth and falsehood, whereas this present world, and indeed you can see that everywhere throughout history, there's this temptation for synthesis, that is, sin is with, bring everything together. And we live in a world of this desired synthesis, this desired, the world of blur. I love it, because, you know, you want to blur everything and make everything confusing. It's multicultural, you know, it is politically correct multiculturalism, where everybody's everybody's position is right, whether it's religion, whether it's politics, whether it's sexuality, you know, you have to count, we all get along, kind of thing. And I'm all for getting along, but not by dropping the idea that there is such a thing as truth and falsehood. Now, that's another thing that goes with the blur, you see. You cannot talk about falsehood. Ultimately, you cannot speak about evil. That's the funny thing. Good and evil, you see, in the land of blur, in the world of monism or synthesis, have no ultimate meaning. They're just perspectives that people have. Can you imagine what evil can be produced in a world like that, where there is no notion of ultimate evil? I think...
Well, isn't it Dostoevsky that said, if there's no God, everything's permissible?
Exactly. Including the worst kind of evil.
Yeah.
That's the sad thing. Committed by people who think they're divine. That's the other scary thing.
Right. Because then how can you tell someone they're wrong if they're...
You can't. And if you do that, you see, you are a cause of social conflict. And we know how to take care of people like that. I think we're moving into a period of persecution. I really do. I know it's difficult for you guys up in Seattle to think about that. Because the Lord has been blessing you with great numbers and keep
going. We get persecuted too.
Yeah.
But in a different way, yeah.
Don't be surprised, though, if you meet, you know, some radical opposition from people who understand these issues and realize what a threat you are, you know, to the public square. And of course, in general, I believe that is growing more and more. So I want Christians to understand why they're being persecuted, all right?
Right.
And if they're not, to understand how they can speak the truth in a world that doesn't understand the notion of truth.
Maybe you can share a little bit, maybe to kind of close up a little bit, the idea of if that is true, then there's persecution with the blurring and the oneness. How do we as Christians, in a gracious way, in some ways, engage these people? And
you know, in a gracious way, I think we have to show people that there's another way of looking at existence. You don't have to be obnoxious, you don't have to be a dork or a dweeb or whatever the present term is. You can simply speak the truth with grace and love. And some people will hear it and say, thank you. And other people will hate you. And that's beyond your control.
Right. What Especially people, if you knew it with truth and
right,
grace and love.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, when you're speaking about truth, you can never be ultimately, you know, obnoxious and angry, because you know yourself to be a sinner who loves the lie as well. So simply remembering who you really are, except for grace, I think stops you from being a sort of one of these holier-than-thou obnoxious people. I mean, we're all saved by grace, you know? So, but we're saved by grace to actually speak the truth. And that's the best thing we can do for people. That's how we can love people.
Right.
And you guys have experience with homosexuals up there. I've had experience speaking the truth. And in some strange kind of way, it works with some people who say, ah, I understand where my sexual perversion is taking me. I don't want to go there. You know, I'm not slapping them on the wrist and saying God hates fags. That's awful.
Yeah.
But showing them these two worlds, the world of blur and the world of clarity, which God's truth brings to a confused world, I think is one of the great expressions of Christian love.
Yeah, because then it's also setting someone up for purpose,
yes,
relationship with the Creator.
That's right. For a life that God intended people to
right.
live.
Yep.
So you're putting people on the right road to be healthy and experience the world in spite of sin in a way that is profoundly satisfying, you know? I mean, I have a wife and 7 kids and now 10 grandchildren, and I know Mark keeps talking about legacy. Well, take that one.
Yeah, you got him on that.
But he's working on it, you know, and
yeah.
It's wonderful. And,
yeah.
and all you guys are committed to that, and I think that is part of the witness that we bring, you know?
Right. In some ways, raising our children to recognize these things are very early on,
oh,
too.
Yeah. We can't do that early enough.
Yeah.
And we can't. And you'd be surprised how capable kids are of understanding at
right.
much earlier ages than we think. Especially these fundamental notions of
right.
truth that we've been talking about.
Right, right. No, this is great. Again, on January 8th in the morning from 9 to 1, we have a pastor's workshop. It's free, free lunch. For anybody to sign up, you can sign up on theresurgence.com. The registration is also a free event. It's open to all, so we're encouraging. So we got more of a focus for pastors so that they can realize what's going on in the current situation with the world today and be able to apply it to their ministries
mm-hmm.
in the church. And then at the same time, then at night, 7 o'clock at night, we want to have open to all, so mm-hmm. people can, from anywhere, any church. We just want to be a blessing and a resource to anybody
sure.
in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, the evening will be much more, you know, popular.
Right.
I won't use too many long words, and I won't use any Greek terms. The pastors are better be ready, though. I'm going to use a few Greek terms there,
Good.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
I'll have it all on PowerPoint, so you can see it. It'll be clearly laid out. So.
And then they can write it down, too.
They can write it down.
That's great. So hope to see people there.